When I first started in statistics, I remember my dad said to me, you know, there are lies and damn lies, and then there are statistics. That was not a vote of confidence.
Welcome to Border Health Horizons, the podcast where we delve into the dynamic world of health and wellness along the U.S.-Mexico border. I am Dr. Emre Umucu, an associate professor and associate dean for research in the College of Health Sciences. We are excited to have you join us on this journey as we explore the unique health challenges and successes that define our border communities. On this podcast, we are not just addressing the issues, we are also highlighting the innovative solutions and remarkable individuals who are making a difference in health and well-being on both sides of the border. So tune in as we uncover stories of resilience, share insights into groundbreaking research, and also celebrate the strides being made to improve health outcomes in our vibrant borderlands. Before we begin today's episode, I would like to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Amy Wagler. Dr. Amy Wagler conducts research on models with categorical outcomes, including generalized linear and mixed models. Her research in graph theory modeling is on fMRI analysis for network and model comparisons as well. She is the PI of many funded research projects at UTEP, with a focus on biomedical and data science and health research. Amy, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with, you know, like your field, right? So I'm really interested in, you know, like statistics, but I know anytime we need help, we always come to you and just you know, jump to your office and then say, hey, Amy, we need help. Can you please help us with some of those, you know, like statistical questions? Can you define that, you know, like what does this term statistical alchemy means to you, and how does it relate to your work in transforming health research through data?
Yeah, it's such an interesting term. I liked your question and thought it's a cool thing to think about. I would say in health data, I wouldn't so much use the term statistical alchemy, and that's because that's really not how I try to approach things. Mm-hmm. I see alchemy as being kind of this mysterious process where you're trying to turn one, you know, one substance into another uh-huh. substance. And there's a lot of mystery, non-transparency around that process. Okay. And I really try to do the opposite in what I do in terms of making it a science where there's assumptions that are well laid out. And then we make decisions according to, in a very logical and mm-hmm. transparent way, so that we can get to an outcome where we learn something from the data. Of course, there is an kind of aura of mysteriousness around it, because sometimes human judgment plays a huge role right. in the modeling that we do. And that should be made as transparent as possible. But I think kind of lends itself to why people often think of it as such a mysterious process. I actually asked my daughter yesterday, who's taking her first course in statistics oh, wow. this year, and she goes, well, Mom, people think of it as mysterious because they think you're just making things up. And
oh, wow.
And I thought, well, that's kind of on us a little bit, because we need, while not everybody's going to be interested in all of those details, that should be all clearly laid out. So mm-hmm. anybody can go back and retrace every decision made, every place where human judgment played a role in the statistical analysis, as it always must. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, especially as we move into the era of machine learning models, mm-hmm. AI models, because there's, I think, a layer of mystery that's even more embedded right. in that era. And you know, some models, you know, you look and they're good models, but I want to understand kind of why did you add that layer to that model? What is that doing for mm-hmm. you? Making sure we can explain it mm-hmm. is so important and so fundamental.
So basically, what I'm hearing is like transparency is like really important, right?
For very important
statistical, you know, like our world, I guess, especially in health,
yeah,
right? So you don't want to fish, you know, like what's happening, but you want to be like very clear with your hypothesis and what you are trying to accomplish, and data is guiding you based on your, like, results, I guess.
And your motive analysis,
right.
too. I mean, ideally, hopefully, any study we put out there using health data, anybody with the required background could go and recreate our mm-hmm. results, replicate the results. Uh-huh. If not, we're not doing our job.
Right. And, you know, Dr. Wagler's statistical word sometimes makes me also a little nervous, and I tell you why. You know, you're making some decisions based on results, and then you say, for example, just giving an example, this cancer medication works or not.
Yeah.
And it's very, very serious decision coming from a statistician or biostatistician most time, right? Because you guys doing the analysis. My question is, like, how has the integration of advanced statistical methods changed the way we approach health research, especially for these type of, you know, like, very, very critical research?
Excellent question. And I'll tell you, that's the biggest, from non-statistician and non-scientist, that's the biggest pushback I get. They find out what I do and they're like, you know, none of it means anything. One day you read a study that coffee's good for you, and the next day there's a study saying it's bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of nuance in those studies that kind of gets lost in translation much of the time. And for years, we held randomized controlled trials mm-hmm. as the gold standard, as it should be. That's the ideal setting by which we can really study the impact of some intervention on some health outcome. And that's how we can really know how efficacious some intervention is. But there's problems with mm-hmm. randomized controlled trials, too, that often don't get acknowledged. Like, how do we really know the treatment works when the randomized controlled trial was only on a certain segment of the population? We really don't know anything about those who were not included in the randomized trial. We also, the thing about randomized trials too in medicine is that they're best case of treatment. And the real world is just not like that.
Right.
There's going to be missed appointments. There's going to be suboptimal clinical conditions for the patient. There's going to be all kinds of problems that occur in the real world that is not reflected in a randomized controlled trial. So in that way, I think this is a huge moment of opportunity using health data, because we have huge amounts of health data.
Right.
And I think we can use kind of some of our more advanced statistical methods to really make some ground, like lay the groundwork for how we can use observational data to create kind of quasi-experimental groups mm-hmm. and learn from that data in a way that we tried to in the past with clinical trials, but with the added advantage is that we can extend it to other populations that maybe would mm-hmm. not have been included in the past. We can take into account real-world circumstances that an RCT could never do. And so I think this is actually a huge advantage that we have now with all the new advanced methods.
Absolutely. I need to ask these questions. Like, so you just gave that example, like coffee is good for us or not. So is coffee good for us or not?
I personally believe it is, because I love coffee.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, absolutely. Without coffee, I cannot think of, you know, my life.
It runs my life. Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, in statistical models, there are also like a lot of hidden patterns, right? And also like some, you know, like relationships, like kind of like being like uncovered, you know, like in health research.
Yeah.
How do you approach that? Like when you work on when you say like big data, right? So first of all, accessing the big data is very difficult,
mm-hmm.
right? But when you get it and you want to kind of like discover those patterns, what are the very basic level of process for us to understand that?
Great question. The thing about health data is that it's so complex,
mm-hmm.
so incredibly complex. Because, I mean, I always say, when I have data on humans, I just know it's going to be complicated. Versus when I have maybe some engineer gives me data from an experiment, it's going to be simple data.
Yes,
you know,
I totally agree.
It's clean. There's minimal noise in the
no
data.
Humans.
Yeah. But with human data, it's just so complicated. And so, you know, some of the methods we've used in the past have made our job a little harder,
mm-hmm.
I think, because maybe there's been a lot of studies looking at maybe one disease outcome and some factor like gender of the person. We can see an association, but if you only have that level of analysis where you look at the relationships between mm-hmm. just two variables, you're missing out on potential lurking or confounding variables that could completely explain away that relationship. Right. So just because we see something's correlated or associated doesn't mean it actually means anything right. to us in health. And so we actually need to take a very nuanced approach to using observational data. The best teaching example I've ever seen for this actually came from a Harvard biostatistician that I met at a conference years ago, but I've used his example from then on. Many years ago, there was a published paper on kidney stones. And they said, I don't remember the names of the treatments, but I always call them treatment A, treatment B. And it was decided in the published research study in a major medical journal that treatment A was better for kidney mm-hmm. stones. What they didn't take into account in the study was that the size of the kidney stone varied.
Jeez.
Yeah. And so it happened.
That's a huge factor.
It's a huge factor. And in fact, one of the treatments that was more invasive was more frequently in clinical real-world settings, more frequently used for treating large kidney stones, whereas the less invasive was more frequently used for small kidney stones, which totally makes sense. But then they totally confounded the data with that size of the kidney stone, and it turns out that with both sizes of kidney stones, the more invasive procedure, treatment B, was better
wow.
when you disaggregate it. So I always call it first day in one of my classes, I have a lesson on the dangers of data aggregation. And when we misappropriately aggregate data across important factors that impact intervention efficacy, we make huge mistakes. And that's why you have to be very sleuthy when you're mm-hmm. looking at data. Think, well, could it vary by this factor? Could it vary by this factor? And not just take a simple bivariate approach. Mm-hmm. And that's where I routinely use causal modeling approaches for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever I use, you know, like some statistics for my colleagues, like very basic ones, you know, mm-hmm. like factor analysis, you know, also not basic, but like basic for us at least, mm-hmm. It always makes me like nervous, you know, like did I do correct? Is it supposed to be like this? I use
yeah.
sometimes like R and then SPSS to check like whether results are coming, you know, like consistent.
And sometimes they'll differ.
Yes, it does. Most time, actually, it does.
Yeah.
So that is the scary part, right?
Yeah.
That takes me now. I'm starting using like some AI tools, you know, like just to see, especially for certain statistical models, right? So you can ask AI and then say, does anything wrong here, or does it make sense when I do this, this, this? And AI gives you like some, you know, like hints, right? And then mm-hmm. like some, you know, like guidance. So how do you use AI in your statistical world,
yeah.
especially for biomedical research?
In a lot of ways. I mean, I use it to kind of, at a basic level, I use it to kind of do a lot of the things that are just laborious and not very beneficial, like mm-hmm. converting bibliographies. Mm-hmm. It's great for things like that, and that saves me loads of time for publications. But I've been having conversations with AI, which sounds really like maybe I'm crazy, but I was coding a model, a machine learning model. It was actually a deep learning model, and I had some high dimensional categorical features, so like more than 7 levels, and that's always tricky because if you use like what we classically call indicator coding, or in computer science what they call one-hot encoding, where you just have binary representation, it overparameterizes the model, and the model just doesn't function well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking into using other procedures instead to kind of create numerical representations of these high cardinal features in the model. And I was like, well, how would you do this? That's what I asked AI. I explained my problem. He said, I would do one-hot encoding. I said, but the problem with one-hot encoding is this. And I said, oh, yes, you're right. Well, maybe you should try this instead. And it was really like I was talking to a colleague
yes.
a little bit about, like, what should I do here?
Yeah.
And it helped me kind of formulate my solution to
yeah,
the problem.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's fascinating, you know, like how yeah. AI just responds so quickly. And then,
yeah.
like, responding in a way... You know, it can summarize like thousands, maybe like millions of data sources, right? So it tells you like, oh, maybe do this, do that.
I was also very proud because I convinced AI that their first solution was wrong.
Well, I couldn't do that yet.
No.
Good to hear.
I, they just went, but you have to realize that just like a colleague would, they go to the go-to solution, which is one hot encoding. And I just knew that wasn't the answer here.
Wow. So, Amy, my next question is, you know, like, what are some of those, you know, like, common misconceptions about the statistical analysis in health research? And how would you clarify those misperceptions to those, you know, like, audience who are listening to us?
When I first started in statistics, I remember my dad said to me, you know, there are lies and damn lies, and then there are statistics. And that was not a vote of confidence of what I decided to study. But that sentiment comes from somewhere. It didn't, like, come out of the blue. And there's a general feeling of distrust, or that we're trying to fool people a little bit. There's a student gave me a poster that I have up in my office, but it says, you know, if you torture the data long enough, you can make it say anything. And that is not how we operate, you know, as data scientists. That's not how we operate. Instead, I think what it's alluding to, and this is how I think of it, is I really use that idea that I think gets attributed to the famous statistician Box. But I'm not sure it really came from him. But he said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So all are wrong in some way. But it's kind of like taking a picture of a beautiful scene. It doesn't recreate it exactly, but you take it from several different angles, you're going to get a better view. And statistical models are the same way about describing scientific reality. Mm-hmm. They give us an idea of what's happening, but it's never a perfect view of it. And in a way, that's all of science. I mean, every scientific theory is somewhat flawed. It's on the road to being more perfect, but we're always working. And that's why we, you know, when I have a single set of data, I don't just do one model. I think about all the ways I could model it. And then if I get the kind of the same story from each of the models, then I know I'm on the right track. If I get a different story from each model, I have to really work on that data. That's some hard data. But, you know, ultimately, I think people think we're making, like, claims about truth and about reality with statistical models, but that's not really how they should be evaluated. They should more be evaluated in terms of how applicable that they are to the situation and how helpful they can be with us making decisions, because they're never going to be perfect. They're never going to be the truth.
Right. Yeah. So what I'm hearing is, you know, like, statistical analysis can help us kind of like having a snapshot, right? So for the situation, and that could be statistically significant, but clinically, it is still a researcher's, I think, call, right? So, or based on researcher's expertise to say, well, statistically, yes, it's significant, but clinically, this may be not really meaning much. Is it?
Absolutely. And that's why I think when I work on that's why working with interdisciplinary teams is so important, because sometimes I will formulate a best fit model. And the doctors will look at it and go, yeah, that doesn't jive with our experience at all. Like, we always have to look at this because that always means something to us. And then I talk to them, and then I figure out how can I incorporate what's important to them somehow into the model so it can inform my process. That's so important and so critical.
Yeah, like, when COVID was hitting US, I collected some data from persons with disabilities, and I was checking whether, you know, like, some of those coping mechanisms can be positively or negatively correlated with, you know, like, well-being during the COVID. And what I found was so interesting. We found denial, higher levels of denial is correlated with higher levels of well-being. And it just took me days to think about, like, denial is a negative coping. Why is it positively related to well-being? And I was reading more and more, you know, like, and I said, oh, maybe it makes sense, because at the moment when people deny it for a second, they may just avoid it and then say, you know what, let's put it aside, right? And
it's
then,
an avoidance strategy,
right?
In that
right.
Way. Yeah.
So my see, like, this was making, like, think days. Like, how am I going to explain this to reviewers? Right? Like, what does that mean?
Right.
So when it comes to your research, I know your research is, like, much more advanced, right? Can you share with us maybe, like, one or two study findings you are, like, fascinated with, you know, like, your health data and health research? if any?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of something fascinating because so much of the time is just kind of, yeah, that makes sense. I will say this. I'm working on we have a data collaboration with the NIH for, there was that big grand nationwide experiment, the BUILD project that NIH conducted. And now we're combing through all the data. And one of the things we found is, you know, when they designed the big experiment across the nation, they thought, well, you know, the objective was to get more students to enter biomedical research careers. Mm-hmm. And so they thought, well, if we, you know, provide opportunities for students to interact more frequently with faculty and, you know, be in research mentoring, then that's going to make them more inclined to enter biomedical research careers. Very good ideas, very solid ideas going into it. But we were going through a bunch of the data at the national level about a year ago, and we actually found that faculty interactions were negatively associated with going into biomedical research careers, the opposite of what we thought. And this is out of hundreds of variables that we were looking at and thousands of students' data. So it's pretty, like, I tried it every which way. I modeled it lots of ways. It was never a contributing factor in a positive direction. Finally, we realized we finally made some sense of it in that we were looking at early stage research students, and we think that the early stage students tend to have more negative reactions or interactions with faculty members. It's more they go to them only when they are either having trouble or in some way in jeopardy of being in trouble. And so it's more often a negative experience for the students. And unfortunately, we just don't have the data for more advanced stage research students, or else we'd kind of be able to compare and contrast that. But that's one thing I can think. Our research team, they kept going, that can't be right. That can't be right. But I was like, guys, I think it's right. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, thank you so much, Amy, and it was very exciting to have you respond, you know, like, our questions, and thank you for sharing your insights. I'm really, you know, like, fascinated again, like, with the statistical world, you know, like, all the advanced methods we can utilize and help, you know, like, public and population to have better, you know, like, health outcomes. And we should be really thankful for what you do. For this community, also for our institution. And also thank you for letting me jump into your office every time, you know, like for me having questions. Yeah. So
it's not that often either. So it's
But yeah, thank you. You know, like, you are always open to collaborate, and you're like again, like, making a lot of, you know, like, difference for people's life. So if you enjoyed today's episode and want to stay updated on the latest in health and wellness along the border, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We have got more engaging conversations and expert guests lined up for you. And remember, whether you are in the border community or beyond, the strides we are making in the health are relevant to all of us. Thanks for tuning in to Border Health Horizons. Until next time, stay informed and stay well.